Good afternoon. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. It's March 8th, 2017, and I open a public hearing on House Bill 5031. And we left off yesterday on gaming enforcement, I believe. Well, Dustin's feeling better today. He's back. Wow, and co-chair Stark is back today. So
mostly good to be back.
Okay. Good afternoon, co-chair Winters, co-chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Chastain. I am a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police, currently assigned to the Gaming Enforcement Division. Today with me is Lieutenant Joel Ratcliffe, and we will give you a brief overview of the Gaming Enforcement Division, and then each of us will give you a brief overview of some of the specific sections within the Gaming Enforcement Division. The mission of the Gaming Enforcement Division is to assure the public that they can have confidence and trust in all legal games that are offered in Oregon. And the goal is that we ensure that the fairness, integrity, security, and honesty of all those games that are offered. And I want to actually note that the fairness, integrity, security, and honesty that's in the banner here on the slide is often referred to as the fish, that fairness, integrity, security, and honesty. And you'll hear that term, protecting the fish or ensuring the fish, throughout this presentation, because that's what we do. We're really ensuring the fish in those games that are offered in Oregon. The Gaming Enforcement Division has several sections, as noted on this slide, and I want to go through the sections real quickly, and then we'll give you a little detail about each one of the sections. The Lottery Security Section, the Tribal Gaming Section, the Vendor Investigation Section, which is utilized by both Lottery Security and Tribal Gaming, and then the Oregon Athletic Commission. While the Lottery Security Section and the Tribal Gaming Section both have regulatory responsibilities for gaming in Oregon, both of these sections regulate separate and distinct gaming operations in Oregon. The Lottery Security Section is bound by constitutional provisions, state law, and is governed by the Lottery Commission. The Tribal Gaming Section is governed by the state tribal compacts and by the authority of the governor's office. The Vendor Investigation Unit, like I said, is utilized by both the Tribal Gaming Section and the Lottery Section and provides background investigation on vendors who provide services and products for gaming industry in Oregon. And then the Oregon Athletic Commission, I will get into in a little more detail later on in the presentation. This map shows a depiction of where the lottery security detectives, where the tribal gaming personnel, and where the tribal casinos are located. And as you can see, we're located all over the state of Oregon, and that's why we have personnel assigned to geographical locations that best suit our needs for providing services to Oregon's gaming industry. Currently, there are 8 tribal casinos that are in operation, and there are over 4,000 Oregon lottery retailers. Specifically now on the tribal gaming section, the Indian gaming regulatory structure in the state of Oregon has 3 parts. There is the Tribal Gaming Commissions, the Oregon State Police, and then the National Indian Gaming Commission. The Tribal Gaming Regulatory Commissions are at each one of the tribal facilities, and they are independent of the tribal gaming operation, and they are the primary regulator for that gaming operation at those casino facilities. Their role is to ensure the casino operations are conducted within the prescribed rules, regulations, policies, and state minimum controls for gaming operation. The Oregon State Police provides a monitoring oversight of the gaming operation and the gaming commissions at the facilities. We conduct periodic audits of the gaming operations to ensure compliance with the tribal state compacts and that there are no criminal activities occurring and no criminal enterprises at those tribal facilities. The third leg is the National Indian Gaming Commission, and they oversee Class II gaming that is conducted by Oregon tribes, and they approve tribal gaming ordinances. The tribal gaming section measures its outcomes of meeting its mission and goal through the priorities that we do when we do our monitoring and regulatory work. We measure these outcomes through ongoing monitoring. These are a direct measure of compliance, which are indicators of obtaining the desired outcome results. Some of the measures that we look at is we look at the integrity of casino table games, the integrity of the video lottery terminals that are at the facilities, if there's any cheating crimes or internal theft occurring, background investigations and licensing of employees that work at tribal casinos, and the cash movement within the casinos, and we ensure that all of their accounting practices are done to standard accounting practices. Now I'd like to turn the time over to Lieutenant Joel Ratcliffe, and he'll give you a brief summary of lottery security section.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Lieutenant Joel Ratcliffe with the Oregon State Police, and I supervise the lottery security section. The Oregon State Lottery regulatory structure is as follows. The Oregon State Constitution empowers the Commission to make rules related to the procedures of the Commission and the operation of the state lottery. The statutes and rules enacted shall ensure the fairness, integrity, security, and honesty, back to the fish, of the lottery. At least one assistant director shall be responsible for securing a security division to assure the fish in the operation and the administration of the lottery. The Lottery Commission ensures the lottery operates within the prescribed rules, regulations, and policies to protect the fish of the games offered. By statute, the Commission shall contract with the Oregon State Police for necessary security agreements. This is handled with an interagency agreement. The Oregon State Police, through the Assistant Director of Security, who is an OSP major, assures the fish of the lottery games, the retailer network, and vendors network, as well as assuring criminal activities are not occurring and all aspects of the lottery remain free of corrupt and criminal enterprises. OSP detectives are stationed throughout the state to conduct background investigations of retailers wishing to sell lottery products, on-site visits with retailers assuring they are in compliance with the contract and the statutes, regulatory investigations of retailers at the request of the lottery, criminal investigations of crimes involving the lottery, and various regulatory requirements involving winning tickets and ticket security. Thank you for your time.
And as I mentioned before, just briefly, I wanted to talk about the Oregon State Athletic Commission. The commission provides regulatory monitoring of boxing events, mixed martial arts fights, and entertainment wrestling in the state of Oregon. And their role is to ensure the health and safety of the participants of all those events held in Oregon. Next slide is a brief summary of the Gaming Enforcement Division's governor's recommended budget. And as you can see, the lottery security section has 57% of that budget, which is just under $10.9 million. The tribal gaming section has 31%. The vendor investigation unit is about 10% of our budget. And then the Oregon State Athletic Commission has about 2% of our all funds budget. We want to thank you for this opportunity to provide you information about the Gaming Enforcement Division, and we're happy to take any questions that you might have.
Representative Palooza.
Thank you, Chair. Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. Good to see you. I'm just fascinated by that athletic piece. What kind of activity does that produce? I mean, I'm just amazed. I didn't even realize that existed in our state. I mean, I know the wrestling and all that stuff does, but I didn't know it was a budget item.
Yes, the Oregon Athletic Commission was previously the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and now it's the Oregon Athletic Commission, and they provide services for the actual fights that take place in Oregon. And so what they do is they license the fighters, they license the promoters, and then they regulate the actual fights themselves. So it's for the health and safety of everybody involved in the activity.
Great. Thank you. Like I say, more curiosity than anything. Thank you.
Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. On that same note, as far as the Athletic Commission, do you guys think that this is the best home for this? And if not, where would you see, how else could we do this without the burden of regulating these being on the Oregon State Police?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, I have not really been involved in a lot of the operation of the Oregon Athletic Commission, but I would be happy to get back to you with some information if there's been some previous discussions on that issue, and if it has been brought up before during previous legislative sessions and before other committees, I'd be happy to get that information for you.
That'd be great. Thanks.
Senator Frederick.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It occurs to me that we do have a separate gaming commission for horses, and I wondered whether that had been considered as part of the melding those the boxing and the other things within that. I'm just curious about why that what the separation is, and I mean you're dealing with gambling there too, so.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Senator Frederick, yes, there are other entities that regulate legal gambling in the state of Oregon. The Racing Commission is one,
right.
And also Department of Justice oversees the charitable gaming or activities that occur. The Oregon State Police oversees the two sections that we discussed today, which is the Oregon Lottery.
Right.
And by constitution and by statute, we provide security services for the lottery. And then on the tribal gaming side, based on the tribal state compacts that the state has with each individual tribe, the Oregon State Police, working through the governor's office, provides that regulatory structure for the Oregon tribes. And the other entities are set up and have statutory authority for regulating those gaming activities.
Were you always doing things regarding the boxing? Was that always part of your mission as well?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, again, I haven't been really familiar with that part of it, but I can get back to you on how long the state police has been regulating boxing and wrestling.
It's been a long time.
Has it been? Okay. Yeah. So this is just
the wrestling, wrestling?
Wrestling, yes.
To make it so they could cover it, because it was a few years back. We were in a few now, probably 10 years ago.
Okay, just curious. Thank you. Somebody has an answer there.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, and Senator Frederick, members of the committee. I am Terry Davey. I'm the Deputy Superintendent of the Oregon State Police. And currently, since about 2014, I have been supervising the Oregon State Athletic Commission. And I started as a lieutenant, and now I still supervise it in my current role. We have introduced Senate Bill 76. And that is a rewrite of ORS Chapter 463, which deals with boxing, entertainment wrestling, and mixed martial arts here in Oregon. It's a rewrite because we noticed that there are, through our education period, there are several statutes in that bill that were in conflict of each other and in conflict with our OARs. So we're doing a complete rewrite of that, and that's why that bill was introduced. As far as boxing, and unfortunately I didn't have it with me as far as the date, but boxing was originally held by each different city would have a commission and regulated boxing throughout the state of Oregon. And eventually the legislature brought it under the umbrella of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and it became a regulatory function of that commission. In 1993, the legislature deemed it was necessary to bring it under the Oregon State Police, and we have been the regulatory body for boxing and wrestling since then.
Since 93.
And okay. 2007 is when the mixed martial arts sport was brought under, and that's when also the name was changed to reflect the different sports that we regulate.
I was curious. Thank you very much, because I know that the Knott Street folks were there. It was a city or a county kind of thing that was being done then.
They were amateurs.
Some folks who were going to other areas there. So, thank you very much. I appreciate the clarification.
Senator Fredericks, if I could just clarify, I said 1993 is 1999 when the Boxing and Wrestling Commission was brought under our umbrella.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next presenter will be Jim Walker, the Oregon State Fire Marshal.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, committee members, for the record, Jim Walker, Oregon State Fire Marshal.
The mission of the Office of State Fire Marshal is to protect citizens, their property, and the environment from fire and hazardous materials. The Office of State Fire Marshal is organized into three branches, and the purpose of these three branches are to assist local fire departments, their communities, and the citizens of Oregon in their efforts to reduce the hazards, vulnerabilities, and risk of injury, death, property destruction, and environmental impacts from fire and hazardous materials. Our Fire and Life Safety Services branch investigates fires, enforces codes, conducts inspections of facilities such as schools, hospitals, and long-term care facilities, and provides technical assistance to community organizations, industry associations, and local fire and building officials on fire and life safety issues. Our Emergency Response Branch provides emergency mobilization of resources for all hazard response, such as hazmat spill and wildland-urban interface incidences. They also manage our Community Right to Know program to provide first responders and the public with information about hazardous substances and their response areas and within their neighborhoods. Our Fire and Life Safety Education Branch manages the Youth Fire Prevention and Education Unit, providing services for prevention education and intervention resources for youth age 3 to 17. The branch also manages the community fire safety programs, which focus on reducing fire risk through the Campus College Fire Safety Program, fire safety for people who are deaf or hard of hearing, home fire safety program, smoke alarm program, and wildland urban interface program. Our priorities are really emergency planning for crude oil by rail transport, potential hazardous material spills on our highways, and fire mobilizations that impact communities. Last session, Senate Bill 325 required the State Fire Marshal's Office to coordinate training, preparedness, and response planning activities which focus on oil or hazardous material spills or releases during rail transport. With your support, we hired our hazmat rail planner, Chad Hawkins, and we just completed our first annual report for the 2017 Legislative Assembly. And I did bring a copy for that, and you're more than welcome to give our office a call, and we'll get this to you. Our response readiness is making sure we have staffed and trained incident management teams, and we currently have three all-hazard teams that are trained up and ready to respond. We also need sufficient budget to provide updated technology, training, and equipment for our 13 regional hazmat teams to respond to complex incidences that impact our communities and the environment. These incidents can have a great impact on citizen safety, effects to our ecosystems, waterways, and transportation routes. And a good example of this response was the Mosier train derailment, in which Regional Hazmat Team 3, which was Gresham and Multnomah County, responded, as well as two strike teams of water tenders authorized through the Conflagration Act. And our third priority is really the reduction of fire fatalities by adequately funding prevention and life safety programs. Our operational efficiencies and successes are really leveraging our partnerships, also updating our technology, developing our programs based on data, being incident response ready, and developing new and innovative ways of educating communities on the importance of being fire ready. This KPM is really the percentage of threatened structures saved from approaching wildfires by OSFM mobilizations. And our goal, this shows 100% of that, is actually 99.5. Although since we're firefighters, we would prefer to try to save every possible residence or structure that we can. The years we're showing are 2013, 2014, and 2015. In 2013, we had four mobilizations. 2013 was considered to be one of the worst fire seasons in Oregon since 1951. Our percentage of saved homes was 98.1%. In 2014, it didn't get any better. We had six mobilizations that year, saved over 3,000 structures, did lose one or two, and we were 99.7%. And then the third one was 2015. That, again, we had eight mobilizations that year. Extremely busy year. Got to spend some time with the senator on an incident and Representative Huffman, who's not here as well. The 95.4% is actually better than it looks when you take into consideration the Canyon Creek Fire in John Day, where originally 40 structures were lost off the bat. We did mobilize a number of resources there. In fact, we had 18 task forces, which is five engines making up a task force. So that's a considerable amount of equipment. But because of where the fire was at, located with homes being built in the timbers on really tough access, we lost an additional three homes on that incident. Well, three homes were consumed. I should never use the word lost because we always know where they're located, but definitely consumed. Our second KPM is Oregon residential fire death rate based on the number of fire deaths per million population. And on average, over the last 6 years, residential structure fires account for the vast majority, 75% of Oregon fire deaths. In 2013, Oregon's residential fire death rate was 5.1, so we missed our mark by 22%. In 2014, Oregon's residential fire death rate was 4.8, missing the target by 17%. And the residential fire rate for 2015 was 3.7, which then exceeded our target rate by 11%. And so if we take a look around the country at the 50 various state fire marshals' offices, we compare by size and by budgets for fire prevention types of programs, and what we strive to be is in the top 12 in the country. I'd like to be number one, but based upon, like I said again, FTE and then budgets, we're striving for 12th, and in 2015 we were fifth. So I think that speaks volumes to the folks that we have over there working in that office. This slide right here really shows our success to incidents response is really built around our relationships with the 317 fire departments, our dedicated fire defense board chiefs, and our coordination with state and federal partners, which truly makes this a complete and coordinated system. And it's been taxed over the last number of years. So you can see from our budget, a majority of our...
Senator Fredericks, please.
I want to make it very clear. It's not just the ability to talk to work with other fire districts. What I found impressive was the ability to bring in private groups with bulldozers and others. And down near Representative Stark's district, you had all these other folks who immediately stepped forward and brought in their backhoes and everything else to be a part of that whole effort because you were already connected with the communities, not just businesses, but the folks who live in the community. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yeah, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Senator Frederick, you're absolutely correct. Oregon is really unique in the system that we have and that we have these great relationships with the locals as well as the state and the federal, and we have one of the unique contracts with aviation assets that are private. We have the 20-person crews, which are private crews, and like you mentioned before, dozers, and we're able to bring all of those resources together to bear on incidences, which is a lot different than most of the states have as far as resources go.
There was a fire, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but you had managed to get everyone together, and you built about a 20-mile road almost overnight because you had all those folks available and you're able to stop some things. So again, congratulations.
Appreciate it. Thank you. As mentioned, ours is another funded budget with the exception of, you'll see, general fund, which is approximately $400,000. We received that last biennium with Senate Bill 3225, and that was to hire that rail coordinator, which was pretty amazing because that started us in the process of thinking about what might happen if we were to have a train derailment, and it wasn't, but probably 6 months later when that did occur. So we're still in that process of planning for it, but we're a lot further ahead than we would have been if we wouldn't have received that. Again, the majority of our revenue comes from the fire insurance premium tax. Our hazardous substance possession fee is right up there towards the top. That funds our community right to know programs. And then our petroleum load fee, which is the one that we utilize for our hazmat teams and their equipment. Really, our 17 and 19 budget drivers are to adequately fund our smoke alarm program, to allow for 8,000 smoke alarms to be installed in residences currently without a working smoke alarm. And we will accomplish this with a partnership with the Red Cross and the local fire service. We have a great relationship with those folks, and we installed almost 7,000 smoke alarms this last biennium. And what we know is that a residence that has a working smoke alarm, 66% of the times the folks will get out of that home alive as compared to those that don't have them. So that's an important program for us. Also, to purchase updated hazmat response vehicles for the 13 regional hazmat teams to more effectively and safely deal with hazardous material incidences, to update our community right to know database program to better meet the needs of reporting facilities, a local emergency managers, and Oregon's first responders on the location and types of hazardous materials within the facilities across the state. And then finally, to adequately plan, prepare, and be able to respond to all hazard incidences such as hazardous chemical spills, crude oil train derailments, and wild land-urban interface fires. Appreciate the opportunity to get to speak to you folks today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question? Yes, so, Reverend Barker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So investigations, the arson investigators, is that primarily the Oregon State Police that do that work? I know they have a, or they did, I don't know if they still do have a arson division.
Yeah, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Representative Barker, that's correct. We utilize the fire insurance premium tax to help to fund the arson program, which currently has eight detectives who have been extremely busy over this last year especially. And we also use it to fund the fire training out at DPSST, in which case they've trained over 11,000 firefighters in the past 2 years. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, would you complete those numbers of how many they've trained at DPSST?
Yeah, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, they train between 11,000 and 13,000 firefighters.
And this is both volunteer firefighters as well as?
Correct. In fact, the majority of those are volunteer. About 80% of the firefighters are volunteer in the state. And it's through the methods that they use by putting trainers out into the areas that those folks need that training, as well as training on weekends, really makes a positive.
How busy are you during our firefighting season?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, the last 3 years or 4 years have been extremely busy for our office, and as well as with OSP, we rely heavily on their folks for helping with evacuations, with helping with roadblocks, and without those resources, because they're just not out there in most of those areas available, and we appreciate that as well.
I know you mentioned John Day, but there's more there. In the state of Oregon, you may be in Southern Oregon or Central Oregon or all over the state because of the amount of timber that we have. So I just wanted to put that on the record to show how widespread some of this activity is.
Absolutely. Yeah, Representative Huffman was here. Dallas has had a real challenge over the last couple of years, and Southern Oregon has been that area in the past we've had the most concerns, and they've been fairly lucky lately, so knock on wood.
Maybe Senator Bates is trying to make certain that it stays
absolutely,
that way.
Absolutely. Listen for that.
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to say as well, I mean, thank you for the tours that I've been able to go on. I think I've been to six fires at this point, and it informs me a great deal about what's going on out there and what we may be able to do or not be able to do about it. So thank you.
And thank you for your interest and support as well. We appreciate that.
Senator, did you participate in the Water Brigade?
I did not. I've done that in the past, but I did not this time.
Okay. Reverend Barker.
It's funny with the weather, so we have a very wet winter and the snowpack. Is that going to produce undergrowth that's going to be maybe make it worse, or is this going to hopefully be a better year for you with all the moisture?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Representative Barker, I always tell everybody that come about the end of October, I'll give you my best take on what the fire season was going to look like, because it can go both ways. What I would say is it's going to probably start a little bit later than what we've normally seen because of the snowpack, but I can't tell you what's going to happen in August and September. We've been blessed because the lightning has not been as bad as normal over the last couple of years. We get lightning, and all bets are off.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So you can't control Mother Nature.
I can't. Thanks.
Okay.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Colin Nealand. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the agency, and you'll have to take my word for it that my first name up there is pronounced Colin. I know it looks like Kayleen, so but it is actually Colin. So I know by this point in our Ways and Means presentation, I know you've been sitting here for a while, so my presentation will be very brief, and I'll try and do my best to be to the point and then answer any questions that you have about the State Police Administrative Services Division. So the first item that I wanted to speak to you about today are the efficiencies and successes that we've been working on at the State Police Administrative Services Division during the last biennium. One of the areas for the efficiencies that we are working on very hard right now is that for our approximately 1,300 employees that we have across the state, the majority of those employees still today submit their time cards every month by paper, which means that my payroll staff every month spend the first 10 days of every month furiously entering everyone's paper time cards in. And obviously that is a gross inefficiency for the department. So one of the things that we are working very hard on is to take advantage of the electronic timekeeping system that DAS has put forward and made available to state agencies at really no additional cost to an agency. And what we're doing right now is we're trying to get the low-hanging fruit and take advantage of that. And for us, that's our professional staff, which make up approximately 40% of our agency. And so that's both our administrative services division staff, but also the professional staff in our other divisions, such as our forensic scientists as well. And the reason we're going there is because the professional staff that typically work more of that standard Monday through Friday, 8 to 5 schedule, they don't tend to have the complexities in their timekeeping that a trooper or a sergeant does due to the job requirements that our sworn have. And so what we're pushing on hard here is if we can get our professional staff over to the e-time system, that will reduce our paper time card entry by 40% and really be a huge efficiency that my payroll staff can then work on to better devote their time to making sure that we are as accurate as possible when they are entering the sworn time cards in that come in manually every month. The other things that we're working on from a successes standpoint is we've implemented a software solution that was very low cost for our agency. And what this has really helped us to move forward on is to really work on improving our procurement and purchasing procedures. It's allowed us to better track the types of procurements that we're having with a particular vendor to help us make sure that we're doing a good as job as possible to adhering to the state procurement standards regarding the thresholds that we would meet as to when we have to go out and have a contract. And it's also something we're working on our fleet and stockroom inventory side to help us order the uniforms and all the things that we need to properly outfit our sworn divisions, as well as one of the things we're working on is to try and also help us keep a better track of our fleet costs and also where our vehicles are at so that that information is readily available to the folks behind me in this room and ultimately help us as an agency make better decisions in a more timely manner and be able to execute those. This slide is just a quick overview of the budget for the Administrative Services Division. You'll notice it trends fairly close to the agency overall. Overall right now in the government's budget, we're about 64% agency-wide on the general fund side. Here on the Administrative Services, we're a little heavier on the general fund side. And the biggest reason for that difference is that with the shift in the governor's budget recommending to move the criminal division over to marijuana other funds, that is something that this part of the budget has not caught up with yet. And that's largely due to trying to leverage the marijuana funds as much as possible on the criminal division to keep that division as intact as possible during these very tough budgetary times. The other funds and the federal funds that you see here are largely related to the agency cost allocation that we have in place, both related to interagency agreements that we have on the other fund side and also with grants and other federal fund contracts that we have in place. This is just another way of looking at that same information. This just breaks it out by the program area that we have within the Administrative Services Division. As you can see, the information technology section, it makes up a large component of our Administrative Services Division. And this is an area that the agency is very, very dependent on. An example of one of the great successes and challenges the department has had is in our recent push over the last few years to roll out mobile data terminals and have those out to all of our sworn personnel. One of the things that has happened is that has happened without any large increase or really any increase at all in our information technology staff themselves. Mm-hmm. And so this has been something the department has been working on to make sure that our sworn staff have the tools that they need while at the same time managing that within our existing resources. And then this is just another way of looking at how the Administrative Services Division is comprised and really just based on sort of an FTE look. And so IT, of course, is information technology. Financial services covers everything you would think of. That's budget, accounting, payroll, and grants. And then, of course, we have procurement, HR, and facilities. And as you can see, our facilities team within the agency, it really has one full-time FTE and then the management that oversees that program. So busy person in that particular section. So that concludes my presentation for you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions?
All right. Thank you.
Well, it's good to see you, Mr. Ball. And I know
Thank you, Senator Winters. Dustin Ball, for the record, with the Chief Financial Office. It's good to be back. I believe Superintendent Hampton has some closing remarks, and then I'll jump into my presentation.
Thank you, Dustin. Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Travis Hampton, Superintendent State Police. Just briefly want to say this concludes the presentation for the Oregon State Police. We have enjoyed the opportunity to highlight the diverse public safety services we deliver for Oregon. Before I close, I'd like to briefly just touch on a few additional remarks. First, I'd like to acknowledge the relationship we have with Oregon's public safety partners. Without our strong relationship with police departments, police chiefs, Oregon sheriffs, and fire service professionals, we would not be able to meet the state's public safety demands. We depend on them, and I think it is safe to say they depend on us. Second, I'd like to mention the stellar working relationship between Oregon's public safety state agency leaders. While the Ways and Means process puts public safety agencies in a natural competition for state budget dollars, that competitive spirit does not exist between the leadership of the respective state agencies, but one of cooperation and collaboration. My colleagues leading Oregon's public safety agencies take a great deal of interest and care in my agency, and I do as well in theirs. I think the cooperative nature of our state agencies would exceed both your expectations and the citizens we serve. Last, and certainly not least, I'd like to acknowledge the dedication and professionalism of the Oregon State Police employees. These public safety professionals that I have had a chance to work with for the past 27 years, both police officers and professional staff, have served Oregon citizens and visitors for the past 86 years with compassion, integrity, and selfless dedication. I am honored to serve as their superintendent and advocate for their contributions, budgetary needs, and safety. This concludes my testimony. On behalf of the men and women of the Oregon State Police, thank you for your attention and consideration of our budget.
Questions, comments before I turn to Mr. Ball?
This has been a really good presentation. I just wish we had the ability to make sure that other folks around the state were seeing this, not just sitting in this room. I know if you're watching this right now online, you can see all of this. But what is impressive for me are the range of things that you're involved with and how you are, in fact, attempting to make sure that things are safe for folks in the state of Oregon. We got to get some more publicity for you out there. So we've been talking a little bit about that, but it's something that I think we need to be thinking about. I think we assume that everybody knows in this building. Everyone does not. And so let's see if we can get a little bit more information out there. Thank you.
Sure. Co-Chair Senator Frederick, thank you for the kind words.
Any other comments or questions, not from the chronologically advanced person?
Thank you. Great presentation. Good.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, again, for the record, Dustin Ball, the Chief Financial Office. And before I get started, I want to thank my talented coworkers that were able to step in my absence of the last couple of days. I truly appreciate their willingness to jump in and fill in for me. Today, I have a brief presentation that will give you a high-level overview of the governor's budget as it relates to the Department of State Police. The agency, as they've talked about for the last couple of days, really provides uniform police services, state medical examiner, specialized statewide services, which include gaming, forensics, state fire marshal, and a whole list of other services that are very specialized and appreciated throughout the state, as well as the Fish and Wildlife Enforcement. Emerging issues that the agency was looking at in the upcoming biennium are looking at the county financial constraints and the relationship between county services and statewide services, the facility needs for the department, their facilities that are located across the state, and really continuing the replacement of the crime view system, which is a much needed replacement. Governor priorities for the state police as well as public safety as a whole are really looking to balance law enforcement, accountability, and treatment options in an effort to reduce recidivism. This slide is one you've seen in other agency presentations, and what I'll call out on this slide is the decrease in general fund from the legislatively approved budget in the middle column to the governor's budget. And I have a slide, two more slides down, that will really identify what those cost-saving measures were that are implemented in the governor's budget, and we'll walk through those. What you're going to see here is that this is really a agency about people, and the staff that are providing the public safety resources throughout the state and the cost to support those positions. 75% of the agency budget is personal services, and another 18% is the cost to support those people throughout the state. This is the slide that's going to break out the cost-saving measures included in the governor's budget, and those are to postpone the purchase of new patrol vehicles. This is 33 new patrol vehicles that were invested last biennium. We're proposing to postpone purchasing new vehicles in the upcoming biennium. It's 33 new patrol vehicles, and this is really going to be leaving the cars on the road longer. It's not ideal, but it is a cost-saving measure that we believe the agency can absorb in the next biennium. We are proposing to cancel the relocation of the Springfield patrol office, to close the Pendleton Forensics Lab, and relocate those six staff to other laboratories throughout the state. Make reductions in the drug enforcement section. This is 19 positions. And to fund shift the majority of the remaining major crime section from general fund onto marijuana revenues. Key investments included in the governor's budget are adding resources in the forensics division to address safe kit testing. This is providing four DNA scientists and two biologists. And we are looking to continue the crime view replacement project. This is with other funds and federal funds. Then we also have statewide adjustments, which include priceless adjustments, statewide state government service charges, as well as adjusting the attorney general rates. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Senator Rogers.
I just want to make it clear that I am concerned about the Pendleton forensics, as well as the drug enforcement section. We heard very clearly from the folks in Pendleton, in Hermiston, about how concerned they were about the ability for them to begin an investigation quickly as a result over there, thinking that there was going to take one to two days for someone from the Portland area to get over there to deal with a crime scene. And they've had enough crime scenes that can really go deteriorate quickly if they don't have someone there. So that's a concern, as well as the drug enforcement. We heard a great deal about that. And I think all of the folks outside of the Portland area, we heard folks speak up about that in the road show. So that's a concern. Those are two concerns of mine. I'm not sure how we resolve those, but they are concerns.
Co-Chair Winters, Senator Frederick, we understand your concerns.
Well, one, I want to thank you for the presentation. Very, very well, and I would have to join in with Senator Frederickson saying that it's one that I would think that more of my colleagues and members should know and see. I think often, and it's not just your presentation here, but the recognition that when I said earlier, when we first convened public safety subcommittee, that we're talking systems. And state police is very much integral part of our public safety system. I couldn't help but notice one of the challenges that you had was the challenges with the county resources. And I'm reminded of the other day, Josephine County, where counties are not able to actually have or step up with those resources, you know, you have to fill the gap. And so I think often, you know, we don't think about the areas in which you are involved. Forensics is big for you in a lot of ways, and we often forget about our rural communities who are dependent upon those resources. So I share the comments that are being made here by Senator Fredericks. And I want to commend you. I chided the fire marshal a little bit. Coming in, wanted to know if I should give him a Jackie's Ribs bib, because he's wearing his white shirt, and I didn't want him to get barbecue sauce or ketchup on it. So, anyway, but no, I really commend you and your staff for a very thoughtful presentation.
Thank you, Senator.
Representative Peluso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just I want to gush a second here. So I was an intern with the Oregon State Police when I was in college. And my senior thesis in college was, is there a role for women in policing? And I had in capitals, you bet there is. And so my career with law enforcement started with OSP, and I am honored to have that connection. I was offered a job, but I had corrected vision. And at that time, no law enforcement agency would really take. Portland did. And luckily Gresham did for me, but it has been just wonderful to relive some of these stories. OSP, you know, we were a small department. We would have three on graveyard shift. More often than not, OSP was the one that came to help us out and to do things. So those are things you just never forget in a law enforcement career, when half the time you're scared to death with what you're doing. So I cannot speak highly enough about our new superintendent, who I have known for a very long time when it comes to integrity. And then I always like to share with OSP, back in the day, they used to rate the officers' uniforms that the troops were wearing at every agency, and actually throughout the United States. And by golly, OSP took that more often than not. And I don't think they do that anymore. Travis, do they do that anymore?
Representative, no, we do not.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's probably a good idea. But anyway, so thanks for letting me relive some of this, my past, and thanks for the excellent, excellent work you provide, not just our individual communities, but this entire state. You're doing great stuff with little money.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you so very much.
Representative Barker, do you want to chime in, too, while we're giving the accolades?
Well, no, I'm very happy with the new superintendent. I thought that was an excellent selection on the governor's part. There was, you know, some people had some concerns. I never did with the selection process either way. And it's always been a good, clean department since forever. I mean, they always enjoyed a good reputation. There's human beings involved there, so sometimes things go a little wrong, but they're usually corrected publicly and quickly in the Oregon State Police. And it's really a great organization to be able to say I was part of it one time.
Thank
quite
you.
Proud to say that. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, again, thank you for your presentation. And if there's no further accolades or our questions or comments, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
And I'll reopen just a little bit tomorrow. I believe we have public testimony.
Yes, Senator.
We are adjourned.
I have security on this.
Would you like me to
reject? I have security on this.
Would you like me to reject?
Adjourned.